November came Japanese Prime Minister Yoshida to sign a treaty with the Allied Nations. Russia, represented by Andrei Gromyko, decided at the last minute to attend. Inside San Francisco's Opera House, delegates from 52 nations heard President Truman open the first session.
The treaty now before us offers more than talk of peace. It offers actions of peace. This conference will show, therefore, who seeks to make peace and who seeks to prevent it, who wishes to put an end to war and who wishes to continue it. We believe this treaty will have the support of all those nations that honestly desire to reduce the tensions which now grip the world.
The next day, the success or failure of the conference was at stake. A showdown fight developed on the rules of procedure, which would put a time limit on speeches and prevent treaty changes. John Foster Dulles, who led treaty negotiations, was present. Chairman Acheson barely had time to open the rules and procedure adoption when Gromyko rose in protest. The filibuster, though forbidden by conference rules, continued. Gromyko launched one of his oft-heard before and oft-heard again tirades aimed at wresting control of a meeting. He demanded that Communist China be given a seat at the conference. To a reply that he was out of order, since the business at hand was the discussion of procedures, he demanded a vote. When the bluff was called and the vote taken, Gromyko was overruled by an overwhelming 45-3. The next day in the Opera House, where 15 years before the United Nations first met, representatives of 49 countries, beginning with Australia's Percy C. Spender, signed the treaty. Canada was represented by its Minister of External Affairs, Lester Pearson. Brigadier General Carlos P. Romulo signed for the Philippines. Herbert Morrison represented Great Britain, but Russia and its satellites, blocked in their attempt to hamstring the conference, did not appear. Then the American delegation walked to the treaty table. Dean Acheson, chairman of the conference, received a burst of applause. So did John Foster Dulles, architect of the peace with Japan. Japan signed last, and a page in history was turned. Never before had so many countries joined in signing a treaty of peace. Marks of 49 sovereign nations were embedded in this milestone of the century. In 1950, President Truman arrived at Flushing Meadow, 5 years after his historic proclamation which announced the beginning of the United Nations. Mr. Truman called on the World Assembly of Nations to bring about real disarmament through control of atomic and all other weapons. Then, the president said, vast sums now being spent for arms could be used for peace. The reception that followed, the president greeted the then delegates of the United Nations. Among them was Russia's Andrei Vyshinsky and Soviet Security Council delegate Yakov Malik. America's Warren Austin and Eleanor Roosevelt. Evidenced by this celebration in France, the UN anniversary was hailed round the world. The United Nations had a record to be proud of. Perhaps most important, the successful stand against aggression by a truly international force in Korea. By ceremonies like these, this one in London led by Britain's Prime Minister Attlee, the free world reaffirmed its belief in the United Nations' future. The ceremonies reached their climax in Berlin, where a quarter of a million West Berliners gathered for the Crusade of Freedom and the dedication of the Freedom Bell sent from America. A wave of expectation went over the milling crowd. Free men know that the surest weapon for peace is freedom. This is the message the Freedom Bell sounded behind the Iron Curtain. In New York City, the new home for the United Nations neared completion, months ahead of schedule. 3,000 employees of the UN were being moved into the new building. However, the delegates themselves met once again at Lake Success. There, retiring Assembly President Romulo accompanied Mrs. Roosevelt. Leading the U.S. delegation were Secretary of State Acheson and Ambassador Warren Austin. British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin and Sir Gladwin Jebb backed up the democracies against Foreign Commissar Vyshinsky of Russia. Schumann of France was among the 28 foreign ministers attending. Ting Fu Chiang represented nationalist China despite Soviet objections. Delegate after delegate arrived. Although many of the men shown in this fifth anniversary report have passed from the scene, the United Nations remains, creating a milestone of peace in our century. Disaster one foggy summer morning in 1956 was to strike the luxury liner Andrea Doria, queen of the Italian merchant marine. She collided with the Stockholm, pride of the Swedish-American line. Here, survivors in lifeboats wait to be picked up. The Stockholm's bow was crushed when she smashed into the Doria's side. 500 survivors from the Doria were taken aboard the Stockholm, which, with 55 feet of her bow torn away, was a somber sight as she made port. But no port would ever again welcome the once proud Andrea Doria. She could not be saved and slid slowly to her doom. Helicopters shuttled the most seriously injured to shore. The majestic Île-de-France, her welcome lights blazing across the Black Sea, also picked up survivors. Some were too young to know, others would never forget. More than 1,700 Doria passengers were saved. 6 weeks later, an expedition of diver photographers undertook a perilous assignment to find and film the sunken Andrea Doria. Chief diver Frederick Dumas was the first to submerge. Then diver Louis Ma, who came from France with Dumas, started down holding the special camera. Underwater, Mal's camera followed Dumas down. Would they find the Doria? Their eyes probed the shadowless twilight. And there she was, entombed in her eternal resting place. A davit came into remarkable focus as Mal's underwater camera followed Dumas along the ship's left side. Her right side, with its gaping hole, was pressed into the ocean bottom. Ranging along the Doria's hull, Dumas fought the dreaded enemy of free divers, the rapture of the depths. The nitrogen in the compressed air Dumas was breathing began to act like a narcotic. Wits dulled, but training won, for it takes an iron will to survive. So after 8 minutes on the Doria, a forced ascent began. With Dumas in the lead, the two divers surfaced 13 minutes after the start of their descent. So ended the saga of the Andrea Doria and another milestone of the century. In 1908, Teddy Roosevelt went to Africa, believing his square deal policies to be held safely by his hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft. Taft was a cheerful family man who had made friends and enemies in the Republican Party, causing some political squirming. Upon his return to America, Teddy Roosevelt, greatly dissatisfied with Taft's term of office, announced he would run again for president. However, in 1912, the Republican machine stayed with Taft and renominated him. Teddy immediately broke with the Republicans and formed his own Bull Moose Progressive Party, whose platform protested the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics. Even an assassin's bullet could not deter the Rough Rider from his vigorous campaigning. Teddy was certainly the best-loved figure of his time. President Taft also took on the rigors of campaigning, determined to be re-elected. Taft had run previously on a platform of Roosevelt's policies. Now he was dedicated to win on his own. Leader of the Democrats for 30 years was William Jennings Bryan. Three times he ran for the presidency, and three times he was defeated. Despite his persuasive powers as an orator, Bryan's famed Cross of Gold speech in 1896 brought tears to the eyes of men and left women hysterical. But in 1912, it was Woodrow Wilson, not Bryan, who was the Democratic candidate. Wilson, a dark horse, was nominated by the Democrats after a protracted contest of 46 ballots. People began to ask, who is this Woodrow Wilson? Wilson had been named president of Princeton University in 1902. In 1910, he was elected governor of New Jersey with the support of political bosses, whom he immediately proceeded to remove from office. Now, with the Republicans split asunder by Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party, Wilson was elected president of the United States. On Inauguration Day 1913, Woodrow Wilson took the oath. Only one other Democrat, Grover Cleveland, had been elected to the nation's highest office since before the Civil War. The new president appeared to ride triumphantly down Pennsylvania Avenue, but in his inaugural address, Wilson said, "This is not a day for triumph. It is a day of dedication. Men's hearts wait upon us. Men's hopes call upon us. Who shall live up to the great trust? Who dares fail to try?" Noble words from a noble man who would soon face many disastrous milestones of a troubled century. In 1916, General John J. Pershing arrived at the Mexican border. His orders to capture the rebel chieftain Pancho Villa and end his border raids. For his 12,000 troops, activity began with the old GI gripe, hurry up and wait. Doing the wash was the low spot in a soldier's life. Mail call, the high spot. The current scuttlebutt involved baseball heroes like Ty Cobb and Christy Mathewson, and Jess Willard, who was the world's heavyweight champion. As they lined up for chow, men talked of the latest movies with dashing Douglas Fairbanks, daring Pearl White, and strong, silent William S. Hart. In camp, there was never a dull moment. Little did the men know then that the ensuing months would prove the war against Villa to be a war of dust and disappointment. Of an enemy rarely seen, of horsemen galloping hotly but hopelessly in pursuit of bandits who had already disappeared like ghosts into their familiar protective hills and deserts. A dashing picture in their leather coats, these aviators comprised the first American Air Force to go into action against an enemy, riding the desert's treacherous air currents in their Genia scouts, vainly seeking Pancho Villa's elusive raiders. Below, a thin line across the vast spaces, the cavalry, steeped in tradition, combed 300 miles of Mexican wilderness in pursuit of the Villa Will-o'-the-Wisp. For the fleeing bandits had broken up into small groups and hidden in the rocky, desolate uplands. Men, horses, and mules picked their way down treacherous ravines on the hot and endless trail. And where even the tough old army mules couldn't go, the men had to push on alone. Marched into a sleepy village to begin an alley-to-alley, house-to-house search for snipers who often opened fire from windows and roofs. The job of catching Villa was made even more difficult by the official Mexican government of President Carranza, which demanded that American forces be withdrawn. Like many a GI since, one soldier makes friends offering a tidbit. Crewmen scrambled aboard an ironclad juggernaut, sure to make the toughest bandit tremble. It was big news when the U.S. Army's first armored car was assigned to Pershing's forces. In 1916, this was the pinnacle of America's mechanized might. But despite all our efforts, the Mexican War was destined to become a futile milestone of the century.